Hey, listeners, have you ever had patients give you an earful for using plastic pill bottles? Introducing Parcel Health PhilBox. The PhilBox is fully biodegradable, water-resistant, and user-friendly eco-packaging for pharmacies. As pharmacists, we know containers aren't just containers. They're protectors of meds and displayers of med info. But they also are your pharmacy's daily mini billboard in a patient's home in their hands. So check out the PhilBox, see how it can fulfill your sustainability and marketing goals. Visit parcelhealth.co today and enter the keyword BizPharm with a Z for 10% off your order. You're listening to the Business of Pharmacy podcast with me, your host, Mike Kelzer. Alex, for those who haven't come across you online, introduce yourself and tell our listeners what we're talking about today.
I'm Alex Natskovich. I'm a CEO and founder of MEV. We're a technology services provider. We're building complex software systems for life sciences and pharmacy space. We've been around for nearly 20 years. And I think today what might be interesting for listeners, I'd love to share some of the experience that I had in really helping businesses win with technology and really finding right solutions, the right technology solutions for business problems.
Alex, a lot of our listeners are pharmacy owners like I am, and we can typically get stuff out of the box now, the pharmacy software, maybe some delivery, capture of signatures, obviously credit card processing, all that kind of stuff. But once in a while, things come along and there's just nothing out there for this. And so years ago, we would do medical equipment rental, and there was not a good program for this like 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And so I hired a company in my town and they got going on something called, this might be before your time, but I think it was FileMaker Pro.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Now, probably you can get this stuff just from a Google document, but back then you couldn't. So I went out and looked for him and he charged me X thousand dollars. And he said, the cool thing about this, Mike, is once we build it, then you'll be able to make adjustments.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent this money and I'm not a computer scientist, but I'm not incompetent around a computer. The guy makes all this. And the big change I was able to make, the one that I felt comfortable with on this program, was I was able to turn the total button. Mm-hmm. I could change it from red to gray. So it wasn't going anywhere and I just dropped the thing.
Yeah.
But it sounds to me, Alex, like your kind of stuff your company does is maybe getting to that level where it's like, all right, you maybe own a few pharmacies or you own a business, you're a CEO or this or that, and maybe out of the box stuff can do some of this.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes there's a link where it would be great to have the computers talking, but it's made it past where you can go.
Yeah, no, definitely encountering this type of situations a lot. I would probably split it into sort of two different categories, I think, that we typically deal with. You know, what I encounter quite often, it's yes, like there is some kind of a business problem. Maybe it's, you know, it would be nice that this system talked to this system or something would happen automatically. And so often, you know, we come in and kind of look at like, how can we solve your business problem with technology, right? And so that may entail really building something custom, making those two systems work, but it also may entail actually figuring out, oh, maybe there's a third system that has both of those use cases that you covered, so you would maybe migrate to another system, right? That's a very frequent scenario. And the other kind of interesting use case is very often the founders and business owners who, you know, they run the business and they see a particular behavior, right? And over customers, right, or clients, or their staff, and they thought, well, it'd be nice to have a, like an app maybe, or some kind of a software that would do this. So maybe it is possible, maybe it is not possible, but this is what I love to really talk to them about. What are the business problems they have? Like, what are the opportunities they've seen? And is there a possibility to really help them kind of realize that business value by either building something or buying something off the shelf? Like, quite often in engaging conversations, my job really, and what I see myself role is, as really helping them find the right solution, not necessarily kind of one that we build, for example, right? Because it's really you as an engineering company building something that already exists, you're kind of reinventing the wheel. So why do it? Like, we want to do something that is really impactful and innovative, to be honest with you. But often if I'm seeing like a use case where, oh, you know what? Like, it actually could be solved by using this system and this system. And yes, maybe we like build that bridge for you, but you don't need to kind of rebuild the whole package, so to speak, the whole system. So that's not necessary. So this is really where, you know, I love to go deeper on understanding like what business ecosystem you're operating in, like what is driving your business, like what impacts that particular problem or an opportunity, and what effect you wanted to have on your business and or on the market if you're building like a product that you want to launch, for example, for your clients.
You and I were talking, there's already some cool programs out there. One is Zapier. I think the other one is If This, Then That or something.
Yep. You're exactly right. Yeah.
It's like another Zapier. But basically what these do, and I use them for a couple things. Basically what these do is they'll help somewhat popular products talk to other products where you wouldn't think, for example, maybe LinkedIn would do something with your email, or maybe Todoist does something with QuickBooks or something like that. But even those programs, there are some pretty cool ways that people can do stuff. So there's a lot of stuff out there. But your company, when you're building stuff, you can actually take it sometimes one level higher, at least one level higher than what we would do as average business people that can tinker around a little bit with things.
You're exactly right. And quite often, I guess if you look at like trajectory of technology over the last 20 years, back in the day of FileMaker or Microsoft Access, you have a lot of the use cases covered by those great tools, frankly speaking. Even today, like every now and then I miss Microsoft Access functionality because it was great for many use cases. Today you have a lot more specialized tools. Often they cover a lot of those use cases, but frequently you need to integrate them together. And I think this is where there's a lot of opportunities for you, something like Zapier or If This and That. But as you go kind of a deeper into a use case, you start kind of a pushing against the limits of those systems. And that may be limits of functionality where I wish it done something like this. And there's just no kind of action, or there's no integration that they support because it may be very specific, or it may be limitations of maybe it's compliance or regulatory environment, pharmacy business, like you under a lot of regulatory oversight. So those tools, they not really geared towards like regulated environments. They're more consumer and business certainly friendly. But if you start to like exchange patient data, that requires HIPAA. So there's a lot of those things where yes, early on, it's kind of cool to use it. But then when you really get into a business use case, there's more things you need to be thinking about. So that's what I often try to do with folks I talk to kind of really help them truly understand what are they doing, like what are they trying to achieve? Because a lot of times people don't understand like what technology can do for them. So I'm trying to kind of broaden that horizon. But also, what are some of the elements that are influenced, like the ultimate decision about the solution? So I generally kind of try to split things into two areas. Problem space, let's define what the problem you're trying to solve and what influences that problem. And then the solution space, what are the possible solutions out there? And maybe it's buying something that gets you to 80%, or it's building something that gets you to 90%, or building something that gets you to 100%. There's variability there, of course. So my role is really help navigate the problem space as well as the solution space and hopefully find something that works.
Alex, now, the other day I was telling one of the guys in my pharmacy, I said, with ChatGPT now, which can give you HTML or CSS programming and so on, if you tell it kind of what you want it to do, I thought with that and API, which I want to ask you about, I thought with the two of those that I could dabble in that more. I told my staff, I said, I should learn this. I don't know what the hell, why, just for fun to see what I can do. Explain what API is and explain how maybe AI could merge those? And is that something that an old fart like me could have fun with? Or is that beyond? You've talked to me now for 5 minutes. You know what I got upstairs. But am I missing something? Is that the thing? The API and the puzzle piece, maybe with ChatGPT. Mm-hmm. What else am I missing in that equation? And what could I do with that stuff?
It's a great question. So first of all, I think ChatGPT is a very powerful tool. And in general, technology over the last 20, 30 years have been built on two kind of competing philosophies. One is really about democratizing access to it. And the other one is kind of more closed source, like more, you know, business. And both have place in the business world. I'm not like a proponent of open source versus closed source. But my belief is that everybody not only could, but actually should try to experiment with technology at the depths as deeply as they can go, really. So let's talk a little bit about what APIs are and maybe how working with something like ChatGPT can help you just get a better sense of it, of APIs and capabilities of different systems. So API stands for Application Programming Interface. This is really kind of a way that computers and systems and applications can talk to each other. So it essentially defines for external world what you can talk to me about. So think about, maybe let's use example of a very simple one. Let's say a door. So what can you do with the door? You can open it, you can close it, you can lock it, for example. So those three different actions, that's your basic API. Basically, with the door, you have three different kind of endpoints, and you can do this action to the door. So that's a very kind of like basic way to explain what API is. For any software application, API kind of essentially exposes to the world what can be done with that application. Through API, you can ask system to do something, you can get some data out of the system or, you know, application. And that's really, without going too much into details, what it is. Every API consists typically of endpoints. So those are those actions that you can kind of run against. And then with endpoints, you can pass some data to it, give it some parameter, like going back to example of a door. Maybe you can close door halfway. So you would call endpoint called close door and pass a parameter halfway to it. And then the door would close halfway. Like, silly example, but I hope it kind of helps you. So a lot of the systems have public APIs. What it means, there's like public API and private API. Private APIs you typically can only call if you have specific access. Maybe it's for internal use, or maybe it's for some sort of a registered users or paying users or whatnot. But public APIs are the ones that you also as a user can typically call and execute some kind of action against. If you look at a system that's kind of maybe familiar to your listeners, let's say MailChimp, which is an email system that delivers email. I don't know exactly their API off the top of my head, but I'm pretty sure they have an endpoint that allows you to manage the mailing list. So maybe add a recipient or remove a recipient or maybe send an email. So that would be one endpoint to which, you know, you can kind of call it, pass some parameter to it, pass some data to it and say, oh, like add Mike to my mailing list, such and such. So that is a kind of basic mechanics of it. And then it would do something and will typically give you back the response. So that is the mechanic of actually calling the API. You call an endpoint, pass some parameter, get some response, it's successful or not successful. So when you're working with something like ChatGPT, what really helps is have some basic understanding of how to put a simple program together, let's say in language like Python. There's a lot of great resources online today. I mean, back when I was kind of learning software engineering, we had no documentation of any kind. You would learn by basically just experimenting with or looking at the code. Now, when I look at younger engineers, it's like, oh, kids these days type moment for me. Like, man, you guys have it so good. So anyway, going back to what I was trying to say, learning just very basic aspect of how you can program in something like Python or pick any language really, but I would recommend Python because it's very easy. What helped you was two things. It will really make your sessions with ChatGPT a lot less frustrating because you would kind of know what to do with what it tells you, right? Yes, it can provide instructions and everything, but you would at least get a better sense of like, how do I actually do this? But it will also, you know, start helping you understand how machines work, like what do they do? And then, you know, maybe it doesn't go anywhere beyond basic experiments, but I think it can also help you kind of in the long run just with understanding of what is possible. So my recommendation, like take a very quick course on something like Coursera or, you know, any other site that I don't really have any affiliation with any, to learn basics of language like Python. And then with ChatGPT, when you're experimenting, especially with APIs, let's say you want to experiment with some kind of a, let's say, benefit verification API. We talked about this before the show. And if it's a public API, it's a known API, they publish the documentation. You can go to the site and go to the developer section and look at the API. High probability that ChatGPT would actually know what that API looks like. So you can ask it and say basically, hey, help me write the program that does this against this API. Maybe MailChimp API is a good example for it. And be very explicit in terms of step-by-step instructions. What do I need to do to write it, to run it, and how to really work with it? So you want to tell it to sort of treat you in a more step-by-step way. Okay, like it gave me a bunch of code, but what I do with this code? Like how do I actually run it? So help if you more explicit with those instructions. I think it gives you good enough instructions to be able to do it. But if it's a private API, if it's an API like with this benefit verification system, most likely you would need to actually pass documentation of that API to ChatGPT. And here you need to kind of be careful with two things. One, if you're working with a third-party company and they gave you access to their API, you want to make sure you're actually legally allowed to kind of take the API documentation, effectively upload it to ChatGPT. So that's first thing, number one. But secondly, it's almost always protected by some kind of mechanism. So ChatGPT wouldn't really know that, and you would need to tell it that. And in API documentation, if you read it, it'll tell you, like, here's how to log into it. So effectively, you take that, upload it to ChatGPT, and instruct something like, using this API documentation, help me write a program that does benefit verification for patients given insurance card information. So those are very broad kind of two approaches.
One of the things that the APIs could do that something like Zapier could not do is Zapier seems to be more having your information in a program talk to your information in a program. Like I said, email to LinkedIn or something like that. It seems like API more, if it's allowed, you can get into certain databases of information and pull that out where something like Zapier may not do that.
Yeah, I think you're right. When you work with Zapier, what you see a lot is they want to support the most common use cases. So they, if you need something a little bit more complex that the API supports, because Zapier also uses API under the hood. They don't have a magical access to the system. They also use the same APIs.
I was going to ask that.
So they use the same APIs. But they only may use 20% of it or 30%. And they also may not give you the full list. Maybe they limit it to a certain range of the parameters. So having direct access to API gives you way more flexibility. It also allows you to construct use cases that are more elaborate. For more elaborate ones, you probably want to talk to someone like me or an engineer that you know, because they would require a more complex setup. But they allow you to do a little bit more interesting thing, like maybe something called a callback, where basically you're not really going to the door and opening it. The door opens automatically based on a particular event, and then it calls your system and does something. Or it may be more real-time system, where you have the data constantly flowing through to your system and something is happening based on that. Or maybe it's based on some other kind of a less typical use case where it's not this transactional. It's not like if this happens, then this. It's a lot more. If this starts happening like more than five times a day, then do this. That's another example where the logic could be a lot more elaborate with those APIs there.
So you have an idea for a handheld program for your business or something that is happening that you think computers, technology can help. And you have these APIs and you maybe have them talk to each other through a little bit of programming. What is the landing point for all this? So, for example, for a business like that our listeners have, it might be Wix or Weebly or Squarespace or something like that. What is a landing spot, though, for having an API program? Is there similar things like I've just talked about, like those website programs? Is there similar things to build APIs connecting on?
There are more tools coming on like these that allow you to kind of integrate different APIs. Ones that kind of come to mind and one that we used for a lot more kind of complex type of interaction, something like Webflow, for example, is a pretty good tool. We use it ourselves pretty extensively. Now we're talking more about kind of low code or no code solutions, what they call it. So this is really a relatively new thing, but the talk of it has been around for the longest time. I remember back in like 90s, there was this concept called visual programming, and it was predicted that software engineer is going to be obsolete by year 2000 because you would be able to just kind of move blocks together. Obviously, it didn't work out this way, but no code and low code tools actually have a lot more promise than earlier day visual programming tools. They allow you to really kind of interact with systems and build systems in a more intuitive way. And the barrier for entry there is a lot lower. If you, for example, I mean, it might take you like a month to learn Python to do some basic thing. With a low code tool or no code tool, maybe it takes a couple of days for you to get to something more productive. I certainly recommend kind of experimenting with them. There's a lot of them, like Webflow is actually one of them. Another one that's interesting called Bubble. They have a pretty robust tool as well. Google have their own tool. There's a lot of them kind of on the market, and it really depends on your specific use case, which in one is better for you. But this is like a good start if you want to essentially kind of combine the two APIs maybe, and you want to land data in some kind of a database and then expose it somewhere to your internal system, or if you want to expose it to some kind of a web page that you build. Yeah, so that's kind of a good set of tools to experiment with those things.
Talk to me about how AI has made your job or your day easier. And we know AI as being large language models from 8 months ago or a year ago. And I know that depending on how AI is defined, AI has been going on for 20 years. But in the last year, has any of this made your job of finding solutions for companies that have problems to solve, has it made that easier, more engaging?
Yeah, interesting question. I think you're right. AI actually goes back way, way back. I think, if I'm not mistaken, probably 60s, maybe late 50s, when the whole concept of really foundational elements of AI started to get built. And so you go through those waves of kind of like false promises. You can even see it in the literature, because every time like there's new development of technology, you start seeing the impact in literature and kind of pop culture. Here's AI is coming. So this one, this kind of iteration of AI revolutions, let's call them, I think has a lot more practicality to it. I think earlier iterations of AIs have a lot of practicality, but it was more specialized, because it gave you the tools that are a lot more specialized and would only be used in a particular use case. Now we have what looks like in LLMs, a tool that is a very general purpose tool that you can kind of apply to a lot of different problem sets and see what kind of happens. I don't really know that we as a business society, or even as like a society in general, kind of figured out what LLMs are really, what is their like the best use case. You see a lot of people experimenting with, and a lot of new tools coming, but I don't think we fully realized its potential yet. And it's very early on to kind of really say, oh yeah, like this is great for this. So for us, we've experimented with LLMs a lot as well. I mean, a lot of our clients come to us and basically say, hey, like I want to integrate LLM into like my product, or I want to use it for this particular business challenge. We work a lot with data. And when that kind of comes together, we have kind of track record of using AI, and more specifically machine learning and NLP, natural language processing, to solve different kind of business problems. So I have some expertise in that space. So that's one thing that kind of over the last year, that interest certainly exploded. There's really a lot more kind of incoming interest there. But for us, from like operational perspective, we still basically at our company, everybody have access to it. So you can freely use it. We don't really limit it. Obviously, there's like limitations of what data you can put in. Going back to my earlier point, like you can't really put customer data in there or anything that's sort of confidential. So you need to be careful about this. And if you as a business owner are looking to really help your staff experiment with, my recommendation would be like just have a conversation and explain the concept of different level of confidentiality with the data and like how you classify it, like what is considered confidential, what's not. It's a good training to have actually on an annual basis to sort of refresh it in everybody's memory. So we kind of let it open for everybody to experiment with, and tools like ChatGPT, but also Bard and other language models from Facebook, for example, Llama is a great model too. And we use it mostly right now for generating copy in different way and helping with communication. The challenge was that we're facing with was that is, I don't think for us specifically it's there yet, because the copy that it produces is too machine-like. In my liking, it is too grotesque. You know, where there's a lot of unnecessary words. Like, you would never actually hear a person speak like that. So what we have to do is prime it to follow our particular tone of voice. And it gets us about, I would say, 60 to 80% there, depending on the type of content we're creating. And so the remaining 40 to 20%, we have our kind of copywriters and marketing team to sort of review and use. So that's one big use case that really helped for us. And same for internal communication. But another interesting thing that we use for engineering, we try to use those tools. Frankly speaking, tools like Copilot from Microsoft, or GitHub more specifically, they're interesting tools, but I personally haven't found them to be particularly useful. They're great as just kind of a get some basic things done, but they're not there yet. I don't think they're there yet to really build something complex. And again, we focus on more complex use cases. So for us, here and there, we use them, but not across the board for engineering, for development. Another sort of a third area where I found them pretty useful, and we as a company also do, that is really more exploratory. So contact, what is out there? Tell me about, you know, this particular domain that maybe, and it really gives you a good jumping point. And this is, I think, kind of what a lot of folks are really using it for as well, is really for brainstorming and bringing up things that maybe you didn't know about. And it gets you on this path of like deeper discovery. So those are three most common use cases that I think here to stay. The other things that are sort of maybe less common that we do is we use it for call transcribing and then just insights and summary. So we use a tool called Fireflies AI, pretty popular these days. We're a relatively big organization. We're 100 people and they all located in different parts of the world. Even in the US, we have like multiple times or so. We can't all be on the same calls all the time. So having a tool like that allows you to very quickly to kind of catch up of what happened overnight in Europe or what happened in Eastern time zone or whatnot. And there's some of those meetings. And unlike like just transcribing tools, it gives you kind of a gist of it, like a summary points. Okay, like they talked about this, they talk about that, like here are the action items. So for me, the most important piece. And we found that to be pretty useful. So now what we're looking to do is really to automate, again, going back to kind of integrate two different systems. So now we're looking to automate those call transcribing into internal project management systems. So like we talked about it, it captured the action items and then it put into project management system that exact. So we're not there yet. We're kind of experimenting with this thing, but it's a pretty easy step. So for us, I think we're going to be there in the next quarter or two. And that already kind of cuts down the amount of time we need to spend for purely administrative thing that doesn't add any value to the customers. It helps us to communicate better as a team and just helps us to create kind of a more cohesive business, I think.
Alex, I want to tell a couple scenarios here, then I have a question on that path. You hear a lot about the dangers of AI. Two come to mind. One would be all of a sudden you have an 11-year-old in your basement and they're making up our president or a president across the pond saying something and we're 10 minutes away from bombing this or that. What's like in the old days, you could say, is this on the news at 6:30 with NBC's logo and stuff? But nobody watches news that way now anyways. It's just all floating around. So that's one thing I know that people could be concerned about. The other one I heard is there's a bunch of examples of this, but it's you tell AI, you say, AI, our company wants to not use as many paper clips, something like that. And AI comes back and it says, kill everyone. That's one way to not use any more paper clips. So those are just some anecdotal things on the dangers. What truly are some of the dangers with AI as you see it, if you do see them?
Oh, for sure. I think with any technology, you have dangers and unforeseen consequences. And frankly speaking, I think you gave two interesting examples, but I don't think we as technologists fully understand yet the impact that AI will have on the world. And I think the same with every technology, frankly speaking. Like you're going back to the famous quotes of CEOs of IBM and Microsoft, and they didn't see market for more than 30 or whatever it is computers in the globe. So I think we're in that times today where I don't really know, and I don't think anybody truly knows what the real dangers of AI are and what the real positive impact of AI is. So I think to the question of like disinformation and using AI as a tool to really create that source of disinformation, I think it's certainly possible for sure. And I think what it forces us to do as a society is be a lot more cognizant about how we consuming the data and where it's coming from, and really go an extra mile to verify its validity. And so really, I think as a society, we have to kind of go through this transformation and get to the point where, you know, everything we see or hear, and I think, frankly, it's already happening. It's already like people kind of healthily mistrusting everything they see online or trusting particular sources, which is a problem in its own right. But I think we're still in the early stages of both kind of a malicious usage of AI as well as a positive usage of AI, where maybe we have more of those tools to be able to validate, oh, is that really voice of some world leader? Is that really coming from a trusted source? And I think there are a lot of tools to really start adding some of those kind of validation verifications. Cryptography is naturally one of them, but there's other things as well. So that's one thing. In terms of a paperclip doomsday scenario, I think AI may be not as smart yet to be able to exterminate human race. It might get there one day. Hopefully it doesn't. And hopefully we're more aligned with it, or it aligned with us. But I think we're pretty far from that. And for something like that to happen, I think it needs to be a lot more integrated into the real world, so to speak. Today, for all intents and purposes, AI is more, it's a program that runs on a huge computer that you can turn off if you want to, essentially. So that's a valid concern. I think we're not too far away from a scenario where, you know, not exactly with paper clips, but with some other means of delivering some kind of a damage to society, it could be possible. And as technologists, as business leaders, I think we need to be cognizant and kind of keep an eye on it. But I also think we shouldn't be too scared of it just yet, because fear is really one of those things that kills a lot of possibility for innovation and a lot of progress. And going kind of too quickly to the realm of like regulation or stopping any development, I think we're not there yet. So,
do you think that the stopping of this, was that face value? Were they trying to be cautious of this, or were there deeper levels of why some companies wanted to stop? I mean, in a nefarious way that some companies wanted to catch up to the other ones and things like that. Do you think it was a true, and I don't even know if you'd ever stop something, but was it a true attempt to look at it? Can we take that at face value?
It's my personal opinion, but I don't think we can, frankly speaking, because I've been in the AI space for pretty long before the LLMs and everything, and I know a lot of it, but not everything. And then you look at somebody who's really, you know, can't really tell the difference between different models, for example, or different approaches, and you're asking them to create the regulatory framework to really enable innovation and reduce the risks. Like, it just doesn't make sense to me. So I don't think it's really like a very good attempt. It's too early, in my opinion, to really regulate anything related to AI. And I'm sure there's a lot of different factors that need to be considered. And I think it's a good time to start the dialogue, but I don't think it's a good time to really kind of go in on action and start kind of limiting anything. In terms of whether that was, I think you alluded to like regulatory capture. So maybe, I don't really know for sure, but it sure seems like this, because why else would you be really having leaders of some organizations basically coming in and saying, yes, please regulate us at this junction, because they're so far ahead of everybody else and you kind of limit your competition there. But for better or for worse, I think the cat is out of the bag at this junction. I don't think it's really physically possible to stop it, because we have other countries that are already experimenting with this. We have open source models out there. And really, I think it would be just wasted effort if we, as a country or as a society, come off to the AI and really, because other countries going to ignore that. They're just going to blow past us. Yeah, exactly. And yeah, so I think we should embrace it. I think that's, again, for better or for worse, I don't really know. In the end of the day, AI is going to be net positive or net negative for society. I don't think anybody knows. But, you know, we as humans, kind of bet a lot on technology to this day, and it's so far it produced pretty good results, I must say.
Sure, exactly. Alex, did I get that right, that there's so many different kinds of AI that for them to stop it and try to understand it and regulate it all, it's like you'd basically have to pull the plug on it because nobody would be able to have a real good answer for all of it because there's just so many different areas to know. You'd have to basically stomp down the whole thing and really never open it up again, because as soon as you open it up again, you're going to have all those different ways of doing it. And how would you control that?
Yeah, I think you're right. I was thinking about that too. I don't think there's really kind of a realistic way, even if you have regulations, regulation without enforcement is really useless, right? So enforcing that at this junction, I don't know what you, anything short of going on the way to some sort of a dystopian super big brother like state, I don't think that's a possibility.
I was thinking about AI now, and it seems there's a lot of people worried about, okay, my head, my face is going to be on the body of this person, whether they're robbing a bank or they're unclothed or they're whatever. All right. So everybody's worried about this. But in my opinion, you get past that, and within another few months here, people can say, what are the odds of that being Mike? So now you might look at something and say, oh, look at what so-and-so is doing. I see their face and they're torturing this cat or something like that. A year from now, almost everything you see, you're going to take with a grain of salt. You're going to say, no, that's probably not Mike torturing a cat. It's probably something else until you can prove to me it is Mike. And now maybe that's going to be a total untrusting of society and so on. But I don't think people are just going to be sucked into believing everything they see forever is true. I think it's actually the opposite. People are going to be having a real skeptical eye on things, which might help people.
Yeah.
Like me, if I was actually a cat torturer, I'm not saying I am, but if I was, I'd probably get a free ride because you say Mike's not torturing cats, when in fact I might be.
Yeah, that's an interesting point.
Who knows?
Yeah, I think we have to figure out like a way, almost like a social etiquette. And I think in some way, like this, I think it kind of goes in waves where, if, let's say, 10 years ago, you were kind of a lot more trust into this broader world and the internet. So now maybe like your, let's call it cohort of trusted sources is going to be reduced to more people that you actually know in real life. So in some ways, I think we got to maybe, and again, I don't want to make any prediction, but in some way, I think we're going to go to valuing those social connections in real life more than the value kind of the connections online. And pendulum kind of swings back towards that until we probably figure out kind of like a way to really have a trusted information coming in. And then maybe it starts going the other way as well. So who knows? But I think it's an evolution we have to go through. It's not dissimilar to something like social networks that came online in the mid-2000s. And so I think we all kind of went through this phase where, like, how do we really use this? What is it? What role it plays in our life? And what is like an acceptable way of using it, or what is not acceptable way of using it? And it'll differ between different social groups, I think. But in my opinion, we have to go through that process of really experimentally kind of figuring it out.
I was just thinking about this. Let's say there are some religious stories, whether it's the resurrection of Jesus or whether it's Mormon, Joseph Smith, I think, getting this revelation, or whether it's Muhammad or whatever. And you think to yourself, those are just stories from humans. Why didn't this stuff happen in the year 2000 when you have pictures and videos and you can capture and all that kind of stuff? But now it's funny because we're almost going full circle where you say, I don't believe in videos. I don't believe in these accounts. I have to talk to somebody about this.
Yeah, no, you're right. You're right. I think that's, I feel like we're going towards that, frankly speaking.
Alex, you mentioned something about, I think you said cryptography or something. Yeah. Are there ideas of ways to, almost like a blockchain, like to prove where the information's coming from and the videos and things like that?
Oh, yeah, I think there's a lot of ideas in that realm right now. I think what we have to be careful there is really avoiding creating something like Ministry of Truth, where there's a record of, okay, this is truth, and then, well.
We've already seen that fall apart with Twitter and Facebook and all that kind of thing. Whose truth is it?
Yeah, exactly. So I think the model that I probably see a bit more democratic is where I can verify what I actually said or did. So I can verify with my cryptographic signature that, yeah, this is a true video of me, and everything else that lacks that cryptographic signature, basically that's not me.
You almost go on to something, if you saw something of you or you produced it, you'd go on and almost put your fingerprint on it, sort of, to say, I acknowledge this.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's probably more, that doesn't really require any sort of centralized authority of any kind, political, social, or technological, like a blockchain. Yes, it's a kind of a publicly accessible record, but then it's still the record that sort of exists. It's not like I do not control it necessarily. But I think to get to like the model that I suggested, I think we need to kind of go through a few iterations where cryptography is also a lot more democratic and easily acceptable. And I think we're gradually getting there. And I think, frankly speaking, like crypto is helping us to get there a little bit faster for all the bad stuff that's going on there. And I think there's very good pieces of technology that can come out of it and good tools as well. So yeah, I mean, there's a pathway to it. But I think it all comes back to what is going to be socially acceptable. I think technologically, there's a lot of ways to do this. But what we as humans going to kind of accept as, okay, like this is convenient enough, this is reliable enough, and we all agree that, yeah, that's a way to kind of validate the truth.
There's this biologist guy I was listening to on Rogan today, and I thought this guy had a little bit of quackery to him. I wasn't sure. Where am I going to go, though? I went under Reddit, where you've got, 300 people talking about this, and it's almost like those comments of this guy being a quack kind of raise up to the top, and then they showed a picture of a mugshot from him 7 years ago, and I guess you could almost say the Amazon rating scale is like that, although you don't know if those are real or not, but it's almost like crowdsourcing of reality or crowdsourcing of truthfulness until you hear what everybody else is saying about it. Only then, I don't want to just say that it's real, but when you see people talking about it and opining on it, you get maybe a better feeling, and maybe it's going to be kind of a crowdsourcing truth in a way. I know Wikipedia is sort of there, but I know that's got some biases and things too, but it's probably closer than just reading one article online that you don't know where the hell it came from.
Yeah, it's an interesting problem because with crowdsourcing too, you have, if the crowd is small enough, you're still going to have different narratives that are going to drive that end result. How do you get to large enough crowds? I don't know what you guys specifically refer to on Rogan's podcast. Maybe he just had a lot of people who hate him, so they showed up for that Reddit. So you never really know. And it's very challenging, I think, for us as humans to kind of really get to the quote-unquote truth. And it's, and truth itself is fairly kind of objective thing, so who knows what it is. But, I think over time, it maybe we get to the point where kind of getting more and more people involved in this process of kind of contributing to things like on X/Twitter, you have this concept of community notes, for example, that I don't know if you've seen them or used them. I think it's something like that. It really helps community and have enough of the kind of people to contribute to something that is maybe objectionable or maybe kind of misrepresenting something. So you start kind of at least seeing, oh, maybe I shouldn't just automatically trust what this person is saying, and there's kind of more to it. So it's not necessarily replaces the truth, but hopefully it gives you enough of kind of desire to go and do your own research.
Is there a separate section that talks about posts or news or something?
They have a fairly interesting algorithm. I don't remember exactly how they do it. I was listening, I think, interview with Elon Musk the other day, and he explained it. But yeah, so on some of the tweets, or I don't know what they call them now, was this rename. You can kind of see, especially the ones that have maybe a lot of exposure, but also something that is questionable. I think people can contribute to it, and it automatically shows what they call community notes and basically provides more context. Because a lot of times in this medium, you see things that are taken out of the context, and it kind of creates this impression that, like, you said something horrible, but in reality, it was like... And I think the way they do it on the back end is they basically try to collect people who typically have opposing views, but have the same view on that particular tweet. So it is a pretty robust approach to it. And the ones that I saw, they were pretty good, you know, in my opinion. So
it's almost like a side wiki sort of thing.
Yeah, kind of like that. But it shows kind of in place, like, so you see it right there, you don't have to go like extra step to research it. And I think it helps to fight disinformation there, and still probably a lot of issues with it. But that's definitely a step in the right direction. So I'd love to see more things like that just kind of appearing. And I think that would help us navigate this information landscape better as a society.
I was talking to somebody a while ago on the show, and we were talking about blockchain as far as some of the values of it. And one of the things they were mentioning is that they say all the technology kind of has its day in the sun as it comes out. And then if it's not really needed, don't spend the time and money doing it. So blockchain, from what I've heard, it might kind of just gradually kind of be there without maybe making it into the news and so on. But they were saying that for things like pharmaceutical studies and things like that, just knowing that data is good. And so if you're taking weights of somebody, that it was 190 pounds and not 109 pounds or something like that, just having that secure data. What's your take on that, Alex? Do you dabble in any of that with your stuff, or is there not a need to dabble in it? Where are you on the blockchain?
I think it's an interesting piece of technology. I kind of came across it, I want to say about 9 years ago. I've been dabbling in it for a pretty long time. And I'm of the opinion that it certainly fueled a huge hype cycle that I think, frankly speaking, hurt its practicality. In my opinion, it just sort of shifted focus to kind of a gold rush, quick money making without any foundation.
And the NFTs of cartoon characters and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, the NFTs are probably less toxic in a way, or were less toxic of an event. I think, frankly speaking, NFTs going to come back and be here to stay. I think with NFT, it is interesting concept. Its adoption is really what remains a big question mark. But I see more and more activity in that space.
That might have to be for things like concert tickets and those kind of things that maybe have some more substance than just Bored Apes.
Yeah, exactly. Or other types of collectibles like baseball cards, for example, or things of that nature. I think the whole, what you've now seen, or I guess already saw, was things like FTX and just the fraud that was happening in the space that really detracted from valuable applications. But that said, I think blockchain is here to stay. We as a company have some clients that operate in that space, and we do some work that's a lot more kind of on a practical side, in my opinion. I do see its application gradually being added to more areas where it has positive impact. I think maybe a few years ago, you would have folks who would come in and they basically just want to use blockchain for the sake of blockchain. But I think it gradually, like, was one of the things that sort of came on pretty quickly. It was a huge hype cycle. We didn't fully, meaning the technologies, didn't really have a very good grasp on positive impact it could have on real life businesses. A lot of new types of businesses were invented, and a lot of them proven to be not really businesses, but just kind of useless use cases. But now I think from the ashes of that, we start seeing new things that emerge that I think have potential. And I think things like blockchain and AI and metaverse and AR, VR, I think they gradually sort of coalesce towards a different way of engaging with computers, if you will, and really kind of different reality almost that is powered by all of those things that hopefully will enhance our human experience. But that's kind of my opinion on blockchain. I think there's still quite a bit there. And I think over the next years, we're going to start seeing it being integrated more into our lives. Maybe not in a very apparent way, but in a more sort of obscure way. You wouldn't even know that you're using it.
You don't know it. Slow creep coming in. Yeah, and you had the whole idea of the blockchain was kind of decentralization, but then like you said with FTX, it's like you need something rather than a guy in a girlfriend's garage kind of thing.
Yeah, and frankly speaking, even today, I think crypto has, it's a pretty difficult thing to do securely. Like you have, even for me, and I'm an engineer, like I know how all this stuff works, but every now and then it gets a little bit too confusing. Like, how do you do? There's all different networks and there's all different tokens and like this and that. And then it's not human friendly. I think the huge hurdle that crypto hasn't overcome is really making it human friendly and easier to use than other systems in our lives.
And they tried to with Coinbase and stuff like that, but then there's always talk about how secure and this and that. Yeah. But I think you're right. And maybe it'll never get there. And I think that's why the LLMs have done well, because of having ChatGPT in your hand or DALL-E or something like that. It's that user interface that's there. Alex, we talked about a lot, but all the different technologies, the pros and cons of those, and there's more that are out there, the voice technologies and drone delivery and all this kind of stuff. Someone like you who's at the forefront of business needs, what kind of things are out there that look cool for you 5 or 10 years down the road that maybe your customers haven't asked you for it yet, but you can kind of see little hints or glimmers of what might be cool 5 or 10 years out?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I mean, I wish I have a crystal ball and it worked. But I'm really, so to me, technology is really, it's really great when you almost don't notice. And I think this is where I feel a lot of things like AI, I think, is really getting there, where you have some kind of an assistant, if you will, and there's obviously products that already try to do it, but they're not quite there yet. But some kind of a semi-intelligent entity, hopefully more intelligent, that can really help you to navigate the world better and in a more seamless way. I wish we can kind of pull our eyes away from the phones and start looking at the world around us and seeing all its beauty. And we have kind of still access to the internet and all the information there, but through a different type of interface. So that's kind of my personal hope. That's one thing. The other thing I really hope technology will do in the near future is, you know, start bringing people closer together. And the people that are very far remote, like you and I, kind of looking through Zoom on each other. We have the, you know, video conferencing, and it's really exploded in popularity, obviously. But I think the next frontier is really things like the Vision Pro, for example, from Apple. Right? I'm really curious about that, how it works. You know, all the reviews that I listened and read, they seem to be pretty positive. So I'm really curious how that kind of transforms the world of business interaction. We can not just kind of see each other, but almost feel presence of each other. Because I think that dynamic changes when you're in a room with somebody.
Absolutely.
It's a different type of conversation. So I'm really excited about trying things like Vision Pro, or Meta's working on theirs as well, and seeing how that could be adapted in business settings and really bringing people together. Again, the technology, not for the sake of technology, but really to the end of helping us communicate better, helping us do more together, and really bridging physical barrier, if you will, needing to travel somewhere. And I still think that's an important thing to do, but that's an exciting area that I'll be definitely monitoring and hoping for positive progress there. I don't really know where it's going to take us. Maybe we as society just reject it as like a silly idea of wearing a computer in your head, like we did with Google Glass.
You had the Apple Newton that was out, I don't know, 10 or 15 years before the iPod. And like you say, Google Glasses are kind of coming and going, and they'll resurface again and so on. I remember there was some debate with Zuckerberg at Meta, and they were talking the two things. One's virtual reality. One is like augmented reality, and one you're like totally taken away, and the other one you're sort of more like the Google Glasses, like you're interacting in your life and you might be able to see something there. Those are kind of the two different routes that this could take.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, augmented reality is about helping you navigate the real world, that maybe interact, just get more relevant information to you when it's needed. And I think virtual reality is really replacing the real world with a virtual one. And I think both of them are a great piece of technology. I think it's great areas. And I'm pretty sure over the next 5-10 years, there's going to be a lot of experimentation there. Because I don't really, we've already had Google Glass and we in Oculus, and it's a new area. The market there is not too big. I think only guys like Meta and Apple and Google can really afford to experiment in it because they spend in billions and billions of dollars building. So that's the challenge for startups really that don't have such deep pockets with experimenting with those things. And that's why I also think maybe the pace of innovation there may not be necessarily very fast, but hopefully it will be pretty steady and we'll see better and better products coming on market and that help us to live better lives.
It's nice to see Meta's stock was back up now. I know Zuckerberg sold some stock because it's about where it was before he did all this virtual reality, frankly, since they went over to the Meta name and so on. So it's cool to see that risk and then the market not being afraid to kind of support that company still, even though they had some risk in taking some different directions to the future and so on.
Yeah.
So Alex, boy, we had so much fun covering stuff. Now, we started off with the Zapier and things like that, and knowing that a lot of things that people come to you with, there might already be solutions for. Give me an example of something that maybe is just out of reach with the Zapier stuff and those kind of things. What's an example of a project that maybe you take on that's just out of reach of some of this off-the-shelf stuff?
That's an interesting question. If we're talking about a lot more complex systems, you may look at things like having a proprietary data feed that you want to analyze in a particular way and maybe create some kind of a visualization that your customers can access. So that would be more complex. Stuff like that is certainly we do quite a bit. The things that are a little bit beyond Zapier's capabilities is when you have multiple systems and you try to connect them together, or maybe like they have relevant information that would be nice to see in one place, but not just that, because that maybe you can get with Zapier or even no code tools like Webflow together, but also enabling some kind of a behavior around it. So maybe that's for your internal staff. Maybe you want to expedite processing of some kind of a data, or maybe you want to enable a new way of really engaging with your clients, whether through some kind of online tools or maybe through messaging of some kind. So this is where you start moving from just like integrating systems to now you're enabling certain behavior, and that's where we can really help make that a reality.
Boy, cool stuff, Alex. Tell the listeners where they can reach your company.
Sure. So thanks, Mike. It was good the conversation as well. I really enjoyed it. Your listeners can find us at mev.com. Pretty short domain name. Yeah, always happy to talk to anybody and see how we can be of help.
All right, Alex. Take care. We'll talk again soon.
Thanks. Bye.
You've been listening to the Business of Pharmacy podcast with me, your host, Mike Kelzer. Please subscribe for all future episodes.